This episode is brought to you by Selby Anderson, the marketing group that helps businesses in complex markets win the future.
Welcome to Unicorny. This is a podcast about the business of marketing, how to create value, and how you can help your business win the future. And I'm your host, Dom Hawes. Okay, Unicorners, have we got a treat for you? Today, we are welcoming Dr. Steve Morledge into the studio, and he is the budgeting economist, writer, and original thinker. I first came across Steve when I was researching more modern and emergent theories about organizational design. Now, you may already know that I'm deeply irritated by hierarchies and by over-bureaucratic structures that most businesses use to keep people in their place. What you may not know is that I've spent hundreds and hundreds of hours researching alternative ways of managing businesses, some of which, by the way, I am putting into practice in my day job. Now, it was as part of that research that I read a book by Aaron Dignan called Brave New Work. And incidentally, he also produces a podcast of the same name, and I heartily recommend both the book and the podcast to any student of positive culture and agility. Anyhow, in chapter 7 of the book, Brave New Work, he looks at how resources are allocated in modern businesses, and he referenced Dr. Steve Morledge's little book of Beyond Budgeting. As marketers, our oxygen is the marketing budget. It's the resource we're allocated by the business through the budgeting process, a process that almost all of us probably recognise as being fatally flawed. So here I was, researching emergent organisational design and a more positive approach to culture, and it seemed to me that I'd stumbled on something that's fundamental, both to organisational effectiveness, but also, which is why it's here, to every single one of us marketers. It's a different way of thinking about budgeting. So I went straight to Amazon and I bought two books by Dr. Steve, Future Ready and The Little Book of Beyond Budgeting. I read them. I was so inspired. I wrote to him. He replied. We met. And I asked how I could help get his message out to a wider audience. And that's how we got to be in the studio today, because basically I think you need to know what Steve has to say. It's going to help you when you next have to put a budget together. Now, I want to get stuck straight in, but first, here's how Steve introduced himself when he arrived in the studio.
So, I'm afraid to say my background is a finance person, so I'm a qualified accountant, and I worked in regular finance jobs in Unilever for nearly 20 years before I discovered this stuff, and it certainly changed the course of my career, and there's precipitated a change in the way I think about things as well. So as a result, doing a regular finance job became utterly intolerable. I left Unilever in 2006, and since then I've basically built a second career around some of the ideas that we're going to be talking about today.
Interestingly, Steve was at Unilever at exactly the same time as Phil Barden, who spoke to us a couple of episodes ago. Now, Unilever's a really big organisation, so I was a little taken aback to discover they actually know each other from back then. But listen to Steve talk about his time there, and you soon realise that his is a world where finance and marketing work hand in hand, and there's another reason for listening to the financier's point of view. Right, let's go meet Steve. Hey Steve, we are going to help marketers today find a new way of thinking about budgeting, but I guess we better start at the beginning before we try to go beyond. What is budgeting?
Budgeting is the process which creates budgets. That sounds pretty bleeding obvious, but it's worth saying. So the key characteristics are it's a process that we go through typically once a year. The output is a set of fixed single point targets or cost budgets. And another key characteristic is it's something that's negotiated. So it's, if you like, a contract that regulates what the business can do in the following year. I think it's also worth mentioning that it's really, as a process, is really quite old. It dates back about 100 years. So the where it all really came from was a book written by a chap you might have heard of called James O. McKinsey, who wrote the book on budgetary control in 1922. And if you went and read that book today, you would pretty much recognise almost everything in that book. It is a process which hasn't changed for 100 years, despite the fact the world completely changing around it.
Which is one of my beefs with when we talk about org design generally, and I think at least four or five times, maybe more on this podcast, I've talked about how the organizations that we have in our businesses are identical to the ones that were there 50, 60, 70, 80 years ago, despite the technology revolution. We've got AI knocking at the door now. The internet didn't change how we think about management at all. I don't know, maybe now is the time, but I don't see it.
I think it is, but it's something that's sneaking up on us. So I don't think it's an accident that if you think of the ideas which are kind of current at the moment, things like agile, things like lean, and I would put beyond budgeting in the same category, all had their genesis around about the first part of the 90s. And I think what's driving it is fundamentally the same factors, which are that fundamentally you've got processes which are fixed and bureaucratic, and that demands a workforce which is compliant and basically has to operate according to a set of rules. And it doesn't work for the people, and it doesn't work for the business either. So I think we're in... probably that's still in the first half of what will turn out to be quite a significant revolution in the way that organisations are run, but there is a hell of a lot of inertia in the system. That's, I think, what is holding us back.
I have to say also, as someone who has been trying to live by some of those rules for the last four or five, or those laws, I should say, for the last 4 or 5 years, it's quite painful to try and do if the people that you have with you don't subscribe to the same worldview.
It took me 20 years. The reason it took me 20 years is because it requires you to rewire your brain. You have to, you acquire in business a set of intellectual reflexes that have grown up around practices that you have seen and you've been part of and have repeated in again and again and again. And you have to break out of that. And it's difficult for an individual to do, but it's much more difficult for a group of individuals to do. And there's always the chance that people are in different places on the journey. And so there's kind of perpetual miscommunication. You kind of think across each other and try to coordinate people's worldviews and make sure everybody's working on the same set of assumptions about the world, about the business and about their job. That is tough, and it requires a lot of persistence apart from anything else.
Yeah, now we're going to come on to one of the breakthroughs that was in your book for me, which was Ashby's Law. We're going to come on to that a bit later.
Yeah.
Because for me, that was a breakthrough moment. It was a tool that allowed me to explain to some of my peers why an approach might be more appropriate. But it's very difficult, what we were just talking about, it's very difficult when everybody is trained. It's an orthodoxy. We're trained to believe that you plan. What's your 5-year plan? What's your 3-year plan? Those are the first questions that, like, the institutions that we all rely on, those people, the banks, the investors, all those people, they want to see fixed long-term plans. But we know that, you know, in the military, you said, you know, no plan survives contact with the enemy. Mike Tyson had a more colorful version. You know, everyone has a plan till they get punched in the face. And then, like a rat, they stop in fear and freeze. And I feel sometimes that's what happens in business. You make a fixed plan, it doesn't go to plan, and then everyone starts running in circles going, hey, what happened? The plan didn't happen. And then investors start beating up executives saying, you haven't followed the plan. And actually, it was never going to happen in the first place. Talk to me a little bit about why that kind of rigidity and why that orthodoxy of following a 3 or 5 year plan, as though such a thing is possible, what are the problems that it causes? Maybe let's start there.
Before we go into that, I think just to pick up on what you're saying there is, there's nothing wrong with a plan. You need a plan because there are an almost infinite amount of things that you could do. And as an organization, you need to have some mechanism to help coordinate action, but also to coordinate people's perception of the world, to direct attention towards those things which you think are most important. A plan is essential. Planning is essential. What the problem is once you've created a plan, is sticking to it when the assumptions upon which that plan have been based change. So that's the fundamental problem. And it manifests itself in real life problems that I'm sure everybody listening to this will recognize. So number one, because you've got a plan which is extremely precise, where all the elements have to agree to each other. It's tightly coupled. That process of building that plan becomes incredibly costly and bureaucratic. I mean, typically it takes, back in the day when I was doing this, about 6 months to build a budget, and people used to reckon it took 10% of all managers' times in large organisations, which would actually make it the most expensive process in a business. So it's costly and it's bureaucratic. And that's made worse by the fact that very often compensation is tied to it. So you're not really negotiating a plan, you're negotiating your pay. So that's the first thing. The second thing which flows from that is because it's such a heavy piece of engineering, it's very inflexible. So if the world changes, it's really difficult to change. In fact, the only thing that's easy to do in that world, speaking of somebody who used to work in a marketing company, is cut marketing budgets. Yeah. I don't know whether that's ever happened to you.
All the time, of course.
Yeah, that's the easiest thing to do. So we lose agility, we lose flexibility. The third thing is that it completely distorts your view of what represents good performance. The way that performance is measured is against a fixed target, which by definition will always be wrong. Yeah? It'll always be ridiculously optimistic or ridiculously pessimistic or somewhere in between the two. It will very rarely be right. So your view of what represents good performance and what you pay for is completely distorted. What really matters is, are you winning? Not have you hit an arbitrary number that's the product of a politically motivated negotiation process. So it distorts view of performance, but in many ways, the most important thing is the way that it distorts and perverts behavior. Because when you negotiate a budget, you set up a zero-sum game. So I'm negotiating with you, so my victory is your loss and vice versa. And the way you win in this game is to negotiate the highest possible cost budget you can, and then always spend it. Because if you don't spend it, you're cost budget next year is going to be lower. So there's an incentive for you to lie and to exaggerate. If you're negotiating a revenue budget or a profit target, the way to win is to negotiate the lowest possible number you can and then never to beat it. So it's ironic that a process which people feel is essential to generating performance actually creates a set of perverse incentives which leads to the opposite happening. Yeah, you systematically underperform as a result of the budgeting process.
So the budgeting process itself is basically breeding dysfunction into business.
Yeah, Jack Welch, who's not necessarily somebody who I haven't got a poster of him up on my bedroom wall, let's put it like that, said it's an exercise in minimalization, and it's absolutely right. I mean, his recipe for the cure is slightly different to ours, but
yes,
in terms of the diagnosis, I think that's right.
He has some pretty draconian ways of working.
Nice man.
Let's just pause there, unicorns, and reflect on that insight, because it's pretty ear-popping stuff. The budget, that thing that you and I spend so much time creating, negotiating, working to in order to get stuff done, the real stuff, well, it seems it's having the opposite effect on our outcomes. As Steve points out, it either leads to a lower productivity goal that, unless we've negotiated an incentive to surpass it, it doesn't even make sense to achieve, because if we hit the target, all we're going to do is make a rod for our own backs because next year's target's going to be bigger. Or it leads to a lower revenue or profit goal that suffers the same fate. In both cases, the smart plan, Steve's negotiation win, is to aim low and land even lower. Isn't this institutionalized madness? Like, how are we supposed to grow our businesses when we're actually budgeting them to shrink? This is a really big problem. So where do we begin? I think we better rejoin the master to find out.
If you'd like to get hold of your own copy of The Little Book of Beyond Budgeting, you can click on the link on the show notes. Use the code UNICORDY25 and you get 25% off.
Now, in your Little Book of Beyond Budgeting, you introduced a law, which I mentioned earlier, Ashby's Law of Requisite Variety, which points the way to a better way of doing things, which I think later on we're going to look at. It explains how systems should evolve to deal with complexity and volatility, i.e. like the world we're living in, the VUCA world we're living in. Could you maybe explain the basics we can put some more online without going into too much detail, because it is something that's quite difficult to get your head around.
It's odd. It's difficult to get your head around, but it's incredibly simple. The reason why I find it important is one has a set of common sense intuitions about the world, that if the world is very volatile, you need to be more flexible. And if you've got a set of very tightly defined goals and you've got lots of them, it's more difficult to achieve than if you've just got one, which is defined in loose terms. So those are all common sense things. And for many years, I was trying to find out, why is it common sense? Is it common sense in the sense of something that we think which is wrong, or is there something more fundamental behind it? And I came across Ashby's law of requisite variety about 20 years ago, and it explained why things are the way they are.
Yeah, nails it completely. It nails it.
And it's a very simple law, a bit like the law of gravity, you know, which is simplistic, simple if you express it, but its implications are incredibly profound. I mean, apart from the fact that it gives some sort of scientific validity to what we do, it helps to guide interventions in the real world. So it says if you've got a volatile environment, you need a flexible process. And if you define tight goals, you need a flexible process. So if you're in a volatile environment, which we are now, and you've got an inflexible process and thousands of targets, it's not going to work. It can't work.
Something's going to give, right?
Something's going to give.
And it's probably the targets.
And it's probably the targets, or people will cheat.
Yeah, okay.
And cheating, you know, manipulating numbers, cooking the books, is a scientifically justified act in the face of a stupid system, because you're introducing flexibility illegally, but it's the only way that you can conform with Ashby's law. So it tells you something about processes, but it also tells you something about organizations as well, because trying to build flexible processes is really difficult. That very easily becomes incredibly bureaucratic. You know, instead of budgeting once a year, you budget 12 times a year.
Yeah.
So the only way that you can generate flexibility is to empower people to take decisions locally, i.e. to give them more flexibility, and in the process give your organization more flexibility. Now, that creates a new set of problems for Ashby's law, which is how do you stop that flexibility becoming chaotic? You know, how do you make sure that you've got cohesion in the business? And therefore, what that then drives is a requirement for a organizational model which achieves coordination by different means other than bureaucratic and process means. So it's a very, very simple law, but once you work it through, it has profound consequences and explains a lot of stuff.
It's also an invaluable tool, I reckon, for marketers. So I was looking at it this morning. Funnily enough, we were just before you came in the office, I was talking about Ashby's law to the team downstairs. And one of them said, oh, that's common sense. In fact, it was Nicola, our producer, said, oh, that's common sense. And it is, on the face of it, as you say, when you start digging into it, actually, from a marketing strategy point of view, one of the ways that you can try and balance things is by reducing volatility and complexity in the external environment, i.e. by focusing. If you focus on a narrower, tighter market, you're reducing complexity. And it could be that this is exactly the tool that marketers need to persuade their other peers that a tighter market focus not only makes sense, but has more chance of success.
Absolutely. There are three parts to the equation. Yep. There's the volatility of the environment, there's the flexibility of the process, and there's the tightness of your goals. And in order to build something which works, and you can apply it to all kinds of things, you can apply it to engineering systems as well as social systems, economic systems, everything. Yep. You have to make sure those things are in relative balance. And changing the volatility of your environment by changing your focus of attention is one way.
Yep.
Or you can do, you know, there are many other ways that companies do it, like you place intermediaries between you and the complex external world. There are lots of different ways you can do it, but fundamentally, they're all different ways of achieving a balance according to Ashby's law.
So I reckon Ashby's law is pretty important. The best way to understand it is to buy the Little Book of Beyond Budgeting, which you can find on Amazon. We'll put a link on the show notes. We will also produce a blog on this, which I'll run past Steve just to make sure we're getting this right. But we'll produce a blog which will accompany this podcast when it goes out. Now, we mentioned that Ashby's law could be a great tool for marketers. Let's now swing what we're just talking about, the problems of budgeting, and look at how it affects marketing, because one of the biggest and most stressful parts of any marketer's job is trying to work out what the budget is and then making sure it performs. You know, they say marketing is, you know, with a canary in the coal mine, it's the first thing to get hit. And we started feeling the oxygen get thin here in probably the summer of 2022, I would think. Now, how does budgeting not just contribute, but cause the type of brand damaging behavior that we've seen, like the stop start marketing?
I mean, I probably would say this because I work for a marketing company. Unilever is a marketing company. I don't think this is peripheral to marketing at all. I think this is central. Because fundamentally what budgeting does, like, it is a resource allocation system. One of the most important places that resources go is into marketing, because that helps maintain the brands and stuff you've currently got, and helps you build new propositions for the future. So let me see if I can kind of map the four problems that we talked about at a conceptual level to marketing problems. First of all, in terms of the stop-start thing, budgeting, as I've defined it, is a process whereby you come up with a set of tightly defined single-point targets for the year ahead. What that does is it focuses people's attention on hitting the numbers. So hitting the numbers becomes the way that the organization works. And if you're not going to hit the numbers, how do you hit the numbers? In a marketing company, there are two very common ways. One is you cut marketing budgets.
Yeah.
Because in the short term, you reduce costs, which means you can hit your cost budgets and you hit your profit numbers. You don't have to deal with the consequences, which is lost future growth until later. Yeah. So that's pretty short term. The other way you hit the numbers is by running promotions, which basically just is a way of dragging revenue from one period into an earlier period. And that does nothing for the brand, and it costs you money, and you hit the numbers. But what you do is you waste money on things which are purely tactical and which don't actually help build the business and build the brand longer term. And also what it does is it induces a kind of like a heart arrhythmia. You introduce this kind of wave, this artificial disruption into the system, and that makes people's lives more complicated. It drives costs into supply chains. It drives noise into performance management systems. It throws sand into the face of the business. Instead of running the business as a smooth, continuous flow, you've got this series of stop, as you say, stop, start. It's built into the budgeting process. So that's the first thing. The negotiation process drives a wedge between the consumers of resources in marketing and the people who are the stewards of that. And it also fundamentally makes the business less flexible. And why that is important for marketing people is that in an ideal world, because you don't know for sure in advance whether something's going to work or is not going to work, what it means is because it's so difficult to reallocate resources, you don't get the opportunity to learn from what's happening in the marketplace. So there's a lot of talk about agile, and I've listened to some podcasts in this series where people have talked about agile and marketing. But all of that conversation takes place within the context of an individual defined project. And that's great. And I'm all for that. And the idea of having fast feedback loops and all of that kind of stuff is all absolutely great and systemically very sound. But what it ignores is the lack of agility in the overall distribution of resources. It's like having a bank that's only open once a year.
Yeah? Okay.
So you have to go to your bank in October, get a loan from the bank manager, and if you don't, you're stuffed until next October. Worse, if you get money in that funding round, you have to spend it, even if what you're spending it on is a waste of money. So it fundamentally compromises the agility of the business. So it's not just about the flexibility of the processes at a conceptual level. It's about your ability to allocate resources it to those parts of the business and to those activities, which is going to have the biggest impact.
Yeah, it's funny, the question, isn't it? You know, what's your budget for this? You know, that's the question you always get asked. As an executive, you're trying to do something. The first question anyone asks is, what's your budget? And if you say, actually, we don't have one, we allocate our resources to things we see value in or that can deliver value for us, they look at you like you're mad. And as marketers or sales and marketing people, we are also selling into a budget for something. And if you don't hit that budget or you don't tick the box of that budget, the business probably isn't going to buy from you, even if it makes great sense for them to do that. This is endemic, isn't it? The system,
yeah,
the problem, the problems.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things we trip over here is the semantics.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's budgeting and then there are budgets.
Yeah.
And sometimes people hear what we say beyond budgeting as saying no budgets equals no constraints, which is not true. So you have to have constraints. Yeah. It's not a free for all. The question is, what's the best form of constraint? If you are dealing with something which is very well defined, so you know what you're doing, you know how to do it, you understand the technology, then a traditional budget is absolutely fine. Perhaps the only thing I kind of quibble with is, why does it have to start and stop at start on January the 1st and end on December the 31st? Yep. But that's absolutely fine. So if you're building a bridge, you don't want somebody to say, we're going to build this in an agile manner. So we'll have a stand-up every day and work out what we're going to do next.
Yeah.
That's absolutely fine. But most of the really important kind of innovation interventions, we don't know for sure. So it makes much more sense to say, this is the amount of money which is potentially available, given our current assumptions, without committing yourself to spending all of it. And without committing yourself to limiting your spend if you find out that you've done something which is much more impactful than you thought. So it's not about getting rid of constraints. It's about framing your constraints in a different way.
And that, Unicorners, frames our problem rather well. I think Steve made a good distinction there. It would be chaos, anarchy even, if we didn't at least have an agreed process of identifying what creates value and what doesn't. Unicorny regulars probably know me well enough to know that while I do like to rip it all up now and then, I'm really not an anarchist. Unless I'm sleep deprived, of course, when I'm completely mad as a box of frogs. Anyway, I like Steve's point about constraints. I really do. I think we need them. But it's about how we apply them. That's what really counts. And that gets us close to a familiar theme on this podcast, a problem that many of our speakers have identified and, by the way, actively combat. And that's when an organization places too much emphasis on numbers, whether that's the revenue target or a marketing KPI. That act of short-term focus, it actually throws us wildly off course. We get so obsessed by steering the ship towards an immediate goal that we lose sight of where we're actually going. People that work with me might be surprised to hear me saying this, because I'm always talking about targets and KPIs. But if you do work with me or follow me closely, what you'll know is that although I'm obsessed about KPIs, that's because they're waypoints and I'm trying to achieve a vision. And I know that if I don't hit my waypoints, I won't get to that vision. So it's not the purpose of the business to hit KPIs. That's the mistake we all make. The purpose of the business is to achieve the vision, to achieve the objective, and that's done step by step by doing the right things. And the KPIs are evidence that those things are working. And if we're not hitting the KPIs, we then need to be able to explore what we're doing and say, are we even doing this the right way? Now, this is not the same as saying follow the process, not the outcome. Actually, it's the opposite of that. Follow the process, not the outcome, is generally said by people who like to command and control, and we're making the case that that model is broken. You follow the outcome, always, because you know you're heading in the right direction, because you've chosen the right KPIs and you're hitting them. And so, in part two of this episode, we explore how empowering grassroots initiatives, building robust coalitions, and realigning our leadership strategies can catalyze genuine, sustained growth. We'll talk specific takeaways for CMOs keen to drive the change agenda, and we're going to hear about a case study where Beyond Budgeting Principles turned around the fortunes of an ailing enterprise. You have been listening to Unicorny, the antidote to post-rationalised business books. I'm your host, Dom Hawes. Nicola Fairley is the series producer. Laura Taylor McAllister is the production assistant. Pete Allen is the editor. Peter Powell is our scriptwriter and editor. Unicorny is a Selby Anderson production.
If you'd like to get hold of your own copy of the Little Book of Beyond Budgeting, you can click on the link on the show notes. Use the code UNICORNY25 and you get 25% off.
This episode is sponsored by Selby Anderson, the agency group that helps businesses operating in complex markets win the future. Selby Anderson's agencies serve global clients in financial services, enterprise tech, channel, industry, utilities, pharmaceutical and biotech. If you want to win the future, find out more at selbyanderson.com.